Hello and welcome to Science World. India's space program made a major leap this past week when it launched an unmanned probe to Mars. Researchers in California are putting together an international database of brain images from hundreds of chronic pain patients. They're hoping that will boost research for the development of ways to treat chronic pain. A U.S. and a Swiss group have published a new report of the world's worst polluted places and the factors that led to them. And researchers announced this week that mammals got smaller in size during two extreme climatic events that occurred some 50 million years ago. We'll talk with the leader of that study that outlines the findings. This and more are coming up for you on VOA's Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. India took a giant leap in its space program this week by launching a spacecraft bound for Mars. If the country's first interplanetary foray is successful, India will become the first Asian country and the fourth worldwide to conduct a mission to the Red Planet. Anjana Pasricha reports from New Delhi.
As a nation watched from its television screens, the 1,350-kilogram unmanned satellite hurtled into space Tuesday afternoon from Sriharikota on the country's east coast. Within 45 minutes of the launch of the Mars Orbiter mission, Indian Space Research Organization Chairman K. Radhakrishnan announced that it is going according to plan.
I'm extremely happy to announce that the PSLV C-25 vehicle has placed the Mars Orbiter spacecraft very precisely into an elliptical orbit around Earth. It has been a new and complex mission.
The launch, a proud moment for India, was beamed live. The ambitious goal of reaching Earth's closest neighbour has been attempted by major spacefaring nations. But only three have achieved success: the United States, Russia and the European Space Agency. Analysts say competition with China prompted India to assemble the mission at short notice. It was formally announced last August by Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. That was after a Chinese mission to Mars in 2011 failed. Scientists say the Indian mission is primarily meant to develop the technology to design and conduct interplanetary missions. Tuesday's successful launch is only the first milestone in this challenging task. Its major test will come 9 months on when the spacecraft enters the Mars orbit. ISRO spokesman Devi Prasad Karnik explains the critical stages in the Mars Orbiter mission.
By 30th of November, the spacecraft is going to leave the influence of the sphere of Earth and will be on a long trajectory towards Mars for about 300 days. Now, at the end of 300 days, it has to be captured by the Martian orbit. We are expecting this to happen by something around September of 2014.
Equipped with five instruments, the Indian spacecraft will explore the surface features, atmosphere and geology of the Red Planet. It will also search for methane, which is key to supporting life. India has billed its Mars mission as a low-cost one to counter criticism that a country which still confronts major challenges in combating poverty should not spend its resources on a probe with no tangible benefits for its poor. Indian leaders say the $73 million cost is well within the emerging economy's reach, and it represents a huge advance in its space program, which has many social goals. They say the mission will serve to demonstrate that India is developing affordable and cost-effective space technology. There is a huge sense of excitement and optimism among space scientists. The mission to Mars has been put together with technology tested during an unmanned mission to the moon in 2008. Although that had to be aborted early, India declared it a success after it found evidence of water on the moon. Former chairman of ISRO, Krishnaswamy Kasturirangan, who played a key role in the moon mission, summed up the mood.
This is an incredible exciting moment. and you pulled it off in a very beautiful and professional manner.
But with so much riding on the long journey to Mars, scientists did not rely on their skills alone. As the countdown began Sunday, the chief of India's space program, Radhakrishnan, offered prayers at the famous Tirupati temple with miniature replicas of the spacecraft and the rocket. Anjana Pasricha for VOA News, New Delhi.
The World Meteorological Organization said this week that the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere reached a record high in 2012, continuing an upward and accelerating trend that is driving climate change. Roseanne Skirbel has the details.
The UN Environment Program's Emissions Gap Report reviews how each nation is meeting its pledge to reduce climate-changing emissions. UNEP Climate Change Coordinator Merlin Van Voor warns the opportunity to control those emissions is slipping away.
The emissions gap is still growing. UNEP believes that it is still possible to close the gap, but it's going to be tough.
Scenarios described in the report find that delay will be costly.
But on the flip side, our assessment says that if we continue with a business as usual scenario, things will get even costlier.
According to the report, five of the largest emitters, China, India, Australia, Russia, and the European Union nations, are on track to meet commitments made in international forums. Other major emitters, including the United States, Canada, Japan, Mexico, and South Korea, fall short. Co-author Taryn Franson, a senior scientist with the World Resources Institute, says while the news is not great, she's encouraged that some of those nations have recently put policy changes in place. She points to a new climate law in Mexico, an emissions trading scheme in South Korea, and the U.S. Climate Action Plan announced by President Obama in June.
Which identifies a number of measures that, if they are fully and ambitiously implemented, it could do a lot to put the U.S. back on track. Measures such as regulating emissions from power plants, improving appliance and building energy efficiency, increasing renewable energy, and so on.
But she says even if the United States and every other nation fulfilled their pledges, emissions by the end of the decade would still be 18% to 20% above what they need to be to keep global temperature rise less than 2 degrees Celsius higher than pre-industrial levels. Climate scientists say breaking the 2 degrees Celsius threshold would put the planet in danger with increased ice sheet melt, sea level rise, forest fires, and extreme weather.
The bottom line, I think, is that while it's imperative for countries to deliver on their pledges through robust policy, ultimately delivering on the existing pledges won't be enough, and countries will need to look beyond the current pledges they've made and formulate more ambitious solutions.
The report recommends nations strengthen emission pledges, initiate or scale up agricultural practices that mitigate climate change, and engage in private and public programs that promote energy efficiency, fossil fuel subsidy reform, and renewable energy. UNEP's Merlin Van Voor says the emissions gap report underscores the urgency to move away from fossil fuels. She says for every dollar invested in renewable energy, five are spent in subsidies for fossil fuels.
And if we can start shifting the economics that underlie that, then perhaps we do see a more positive picture emerging.
The emissions gap report quantifies country pledges. Now Van Voor says nations must step up and take action that makes a difference for the planet. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
It's time again for the Science World Quick Quiz. Roseanne Skirbel just told us that a new report says that the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere reached a record high in 2012. Of the following, which is not considered to be a greenhouse gas? Is it A, argon, B, water vapor, or C, methane? Think about it and see if you can come up with the right answer. We'll give you the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
This is Science World on VOA. Be sure to visit our new website and blog at voanews.com/science.
Researchers at the University of California, Los Angeles, are developing an international database of brain images of hundreds of chronic pain patients. The goal? To accelerate research and develop better ways to treat chronic pain. Elizabeth Lee reports from Los Angeles.
Carolyn Crow is no stranger to pain.
Sometimes I'll have just kind of a background dull ache, you know, all the time. Sometimes there's cramping that's so bad that it'll just kind of almost double you over in pain.
It is a chronic pain caused by irritable bowel syndrome, an illness that currently has no cure. UCLA gastroenterologist Emeryn Meyer says this disease is not the only cause of chronic pain in the body, and patients often can only suffer.
One of the big things in pain research has been the failure to really come up with, you know, major breakthroughs in treatments.
In hopes of finding new treatment options, Meyer is working on a new field of study that links chronic pain to biological changes in the brain. The Oppenheimer Center for Neurobiology of Stress at UCLA serves as the main hub for the first standardized database for brain imaging connected to chronic pain.
So I think a lot of people now agree with the concept that chronic pain is a brain disease. It may start anywhere in the body when you have acute pain, but once it becomes a chronic pain syndrome, it does become a brain disease.
Kirsten Tillisch, a professor in UCLA's Division of Digestive Diseases, says the database allows doctors to take a more holistic approach in chronic pain research.
One of the failures of Western medicine, and I think also our research approaches, is how we've diced up the human body and we've diced up research into these little silos that work very independently.
Meyer says Western scientists are starting to look more closely at how mind, body, and environment affect each other, and his database is one example.
Big data medicine and analysis is essentially doing the same thing that, you know, the ancient Chinese did by observation. We do it by observing and analyzing very large data sets and trying to see, are there patterns in there that hang together biologically.
And Tillisch says new technology makes this possible.
You know, when I started this type of work 10 years ago, we didn't have computing power to do these types of analysis. So in the brain alone, in the last decade, it's really exploded what we could look at.
The database currently holds the brain scans of more than 500 patients from North America and Europe. And UCLA is in the process of acquiring more. Meyer hopes to eventually include brain images of people from Asian countries, plus other biological markers that can help researchers understand pain and find treatments that can help improve the quality of life for patients, such as Carolyn Crow.
As a patient receiving care, it makes you feel much better also to realize that the doctor is treating you as a person and a whole being with many complicated parts.
I just want to take a quick look at your belly.
Okay.
And then you want to lay down. Okay. So the first thing, if you could just show me what part of your belly you typically feel your pain.
Images of Crow's brain will also be in the database. She hopes one day doctors might find a cure for her chronic pain. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
The Blacksmith Institute in the United States and Green Cross of Switzerland have published a 2013 report of the world's worst polluted places and human activities that led to them. Zlatissa Hoke has this report.
Decomposed whale carcasses have been washing up on the beaches of Ghana's oil-producing west in recent years, including at least 8 since September. Emmanuel Korshi, a construction worker from Accra, is puzzled.
I'm very surprised because I think normally whales don't normally die like that. So I'm surprised 4 whales have died just at the pool. So I'm even thinking what has happened in the sea before all these things are happening. So if it would be a question to me that I don't know the reason why these things are happening. So maybe I think maybe it might be a collision by maybe a ship getting into contact with them or something else.
But environmentalists are less puzzled. They say Ghana's growing petroleum industry is most likely killing the marine life. In addition, a U.S. and a Swiss environmental organization this week jointly identified a suburb of Ghana's capital as the place most threatened by toxic waste. Agbogbloshi is a dumping place for used electronics, refrigerators, microwave appliances, and televisions. The burning of heavy metals and other industrial waste releases fumes that seep into people's homes, food markets, and other public areas, causing diseases, birth defects, and even death. More than a quarter century after the 1986 nuclear disaster, Ukraine's Chernobyl continues to pose a toxic threat as the radioactive material deposited on the ground after the explosion contaminates food plants and animals in the region. Villa Inflamable near Buenos Aires is one of the worst polluted shantytowns in the Matanza-Riachuelo River Basin. Horacio Rojas heads the local clean water advocacy group Foro Hídrico de Lanús.
The white that you see, these are chemicals poured directly into the water.
This mother of three says they cannot open the window because of the smell. South African environmentalist Mariette Liefering is working to raise awareness of the pollution caused by mining in her country. Here she is showing a group of African politicians a river contaminated with acid from gold and mineral mines.
My lesson to this delegation is if mining commences, there must be strict management rules in place. There must be provision made financially for not only the costs and the impacts during the operations of the mine, but the post-closure impacts, which can continue in the case of acid mine drainage for hundreds of years.
US and Swiss environmentalists say 200 million people around the world are at risk from toxic pollution caused by industrial waste and human activity, and the numbers are growing. The Chernobyl example shows that the cleanup process can be very slow. Slavica Ho, VOA News, Washington.
Do you think you have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Well, let's find out. This week, we wanted to know which of the following is not considered to be a greenhouse gas. Is it A, argon, B, water vapor, or C, methane? The answer is A, argon. It's the third most common gas in the Earth's atmosphere. Unlike a gas such as carbon dioxide, which can absorb and re-radiate infrared radiation, causing the greenhouse effect, argon and other gases like it, such as nitrogen and oxygen, are almost totally unaffected by infrared radiation. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
Thanks for listening to VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine, Science World.
Researchers have found that two extreme climate change events called hyperthermals some 50 to 55 million years ago have been linked to two occasions where mammals over the course of evolution actually shrank in size. Scientists have known from previous research that mammal size got smaller during the largest of these hyperthermal events. But in recent research that was presented this week at the Society of Vertebrate Paleontology's annual meeting in Los Angeles, a second, smaller hyperthermal event also caused a similar decrease in mammals' body size. The researchers said that following both climatic events, the body size of the animals rebounded. The research team said that their discovery, the link between the two climate events, could provide scientists with some insight and understanding in light of current concern over climate change. Abigail D'Ambrosia, writing for her doctoral thesis at the University of New Hampshire, led the study. She joins us for today's one-on-one segment to talk about what she and her team learned throughout the course of their research. What is the link between mammalian dwarfism and climate change?
Well, what we know now is that we have found evidence of two very extreme global warming events that occurred between 53 and 55 million years ago. And what we have found through fossil evidence is that mammal body size seems to be shrinking in the middle of these global warming events and rebounding afterwards.
Two events during the Paleogene era caused dwarfism. What were they and what brought on the events?
The very first and most extreme warming event that we know about is known as the Paleocene, Eocene Thermal Maximum, or PETM. And this event was associated with extreme amounts of carbon dioxide being injected into the atmosphere essentially at once geologically speaking. And associated with this event was a global temperature rise of about 5 to 9 degrees Celsius. And what scientists noticed in terrestrial records when we found this event, or when other scientists found this event, is that this seems to coincide with this mammalian dwarfism. Now, just recently, in continental records, was another smaller of these global warming events found. This is a very similar type of event associated, again, with this very extreme carbon dioxide injection into the atmosphere. And it's associated with perhaps about 3 degrees rise in global warming. And again, this is where we're finding this mammal dwarfism.
Now, I understand that the Paleogene era was a pretty important time for the development and evolution of the mammalian species, going from relatively small species to large and diverse groups.
So the mammals that we actually focus on in our study are the first horses. So they were very small, about the size of a small dog. And we also looked at the first primates, known as Cantheus, and some other very early ungulates or hoofed animals known as Diakitexis and Hyopsis.
Could evolution itself be the cause of the two instances of dwarfism in mammals rather than specific environmental events?
So there's two ideas behind what is causing the dwarfism. And they sort of have to do with, you know, these species evolving over these periods of time. And so one idea is that this large amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is decreasing the nutritional quality of the plants that these animals are eating. So in turn, these animals are dwarfing in body size and response. And this is happening over, you know, 100,000 years, actually quite less probably, but it's happening over a long period of time. The other idea is that the temperatures themselves, the increase, is just causing this response in body size decrease because it's simply more efficient to cool off if you are smaller. You have a greater surface area to volume ratio, so it's more efficient to cool off that way.
I understand that body sizes in mammals rebounded following both hypothermal events. Can you give us some examples of that?
I should start with saying that the best simple mammal that we have is this early horse. And a study that came out in 2012 specifically looked at this horse across the PEPM, which is a very extreme global warming event compared to the smaller one that I studied. And what they found is this horse decreased in body size 30% going into the middle of this hypothermal global warming event. And then afterwards, it rebounded about 79%, I believe. So when we look at our records at smaller global warming event, we find that the same lineage of horse decreased in body size only 19%. It rebounded to its previous body size when this global warming event ended. And so what's interesting is that the size of a global warming event or the magnitude of these global warming events, there might be a relationship between that and the amount of dwarfism that we see.
With escalating concern with climate change, is there some concern that something like this could happen again, perhaps even affecting the human species?
Yeah, you know, that's interesting. Obviously, I focus in the past, so it's hard to say what could happen in the future. You know, really, our evidence comes from this horse, right? It's hard to say what mammalian species or lineages it could affect today. My guess is it wouldn't affect humans too much because we have so much control over our own environment. But perhaps for some wild, you know, more wild species in more wild regions of the world, it could potentially affect them. But again, this is something we have to work on. It'd be nice to get more data on other types of mammalian lineages and also look at other types of global warming events that are perhaps not so similar to the style of global warming events that we look at in this study. I think most striking thing about these two global warming events is they happen in a period of less than 200,000 years, and that is really a blink of an eye, you know, when we're thinking in geological terms.
That was Abigail D'Ambrosia from the University of New Hampshire in Durham, New Hampshire. That's it for this edition of Science World. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I am Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.